Welcome. You're listening to Red Centre, your weekly roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
And welcome to our first ever Red Centre podcast. And I'm joined, as hopefully always, by Jason. How are you, mate?
Good, mate. How are you going?
So now, everyone, well, not everybody, a lot of people that listen to the FX Guide podcast know me, but they won't know you. So let's get some of your background for those that that don't know you.
Well, I'm a director in Sydney, mainly TVCs, television commercials. But I guess my background, my old life, was about 12 years in the camera department, I guess, growing up straight from school, sitting on an Apple box, pulling focus for a decade. And so I guess, even though I've moved to the directing thing, I haven't really lost that sort of love of the gadgets and the gear and, you know, keeping it simple, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I thought it'd be really good. When you suggested this to me, I thought it'd be a really good combination, because obviously I've got pretty much a heavy-duty post background. You've got both the technical side of production and filming from, you know, as you say, but also just as an A-grade director, you just have to deal with the realities of pulling off the shot, and I think that's a good balance. So hopefully together we can walk our way through the ever-changing landscape that is our interest here on Red Centre.
Well, I think that was the thing, just wanted to cut through, you know, that whole, there's so much static about, so much on rednews.net, and there's so much there that we really wanted to kind of cut to the chase, really. There's a lot of people who don't have their cameras yet, a lot of people who, there's a lot of all that sort of wondering, you know, what can I, you know, all that sort of stuff you do before you've got your gear. And obviously the whole post side of things is really,
yeah, well, I think really the thing for great. Me is that actually keeping up with what's happening in the Red community is a pretty much near full-time job. Now, we've got spies and a research team who are going to be each week tracking stuff that's happening and then flagging it for us. And then what we hope to do is be able to summarize that for you guys. So, for example, this week, Build 15 came out. We'll talk about that in 1 second. But that's the sort of stuff that you may know. You may not even know that, right? But what does Build 15 mean? Has anyone actually shot with it? And we were shooting with it yesterday. You know, does it work? The frame rates, you know, some of the realities of it. And then hopefully by listening to this, you can get a kind of, we hope to do this fortnightly, update on just sort of what's the current state of the art. So if you're hiring the camera, using the camera, or just having to deal with the footage that's coming off the camera, you've got a good idea as to the kind of current state of the art. And of course, with NAB coming up, it's going to change again.
Drastically. Another game changer.
Another game changer. And we'll be broadcasting live from NAB and covering stuff, both here with Red Centre and also in the traditional FX Guide and FX PhD forums. But to me, let's just back up one whole step and give me your take on the significance of the camera, leaving aside the hype and the carry-on and stuff. I mean, just how realistic is this camera in terms of its overall design for the sort of work that you do in you know, your everyday kind of professional life?
Sure. Well, I guess obviously the main caveat is the classic kind of film will always hold a special place in my heart kind of comment. And obviously that is still, you know, that's still there to a great degree. I guess for me, some of the attractions of the solid state kind of stuff, I guess, versus film is if I can get a sort of a film look and not have to sort of suffer all the things like a mag change every 4 minutes, being able to roll. For me, I do a lot of drama and a lot of dialogue and things, and for me there's a lot of things in the whole kind of sync sound, standby, marker, slate kind of sphincter tightening process that I really kind of, there's something lovely about this sort of silent little machine that sort of, you know, can quietly roll and be a bit sort of covert there. And
because it is kind of an intrusive process to the acting. I mean, like, let's leave aside the second for the ads that you don't do, but, you know, the sort of eye candy ads where you've just got, you know, effectively moving props that we call actors. Mm. But anyone doing actual acting, it's quite an intrusive process, isn't it? Actually having to stop, start, and
sure.
Have these literally clapperboards clapping in front of their face constantly.
You can absolutely guarantee that, you know, when everyone finally sort of gets in the whole sort of swing of a shot, and all the actors really sort of get into that, you know, find their feet, I guess, guarantee, you know, you'll need a reload. And then that whole sort of, you almost have to sort of start again. Everyone has to kind of get back in the swing of things. So I think, yeah, being able to, for me, it's being able to, it sounds silly because the camera does so many other things, but for many, one of the main things for me is that it can, you know, we can roll for, you know, I don't have to sort of stop every 4 minutes.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Now, the other thing is that in terms of image quality, one of the things that we'll be referring to constantly, I'm sure, is that sort of filmic look. And I guess the number one thing that just smacks you is the depth of field. Because getting that lovely 35 mil kind of depth of field thing, which comes from the inherent design of the camera, really is, I guess, first and foremost, one of the principal differences between it and, say, a camera costing, God, like 10 times as much in something like the F23.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, coming from that side of things, yeah, the depth of field is something I've really wanted to, up until now, haven't really been, apart from Genesis, which is, you know, for a lot of productions, is kind of out of the ballpark, really. You know, it rents, just to get a body only, to rent it, is twice the cost of a film camera. You know, obviously, that is a real, these days, you know, budgets aren't getting any better.
Yeah, and I think that, while the red lenses are great, you know, this just allows you to use your favorite lenses and they can be, you know, just gorgeous pieces of glass.
It looks fantastic on set. You know, you've got big monitors, clients really love it. It's, you know, you've got big monitoring, you've got the last shoot I did, we had like the Cook S4s, and it just looks fantastic, and everyone really loves seeing, you know, the what you see is what you get on set is fantastic.
Before we get to the latest, you know, releases and stuff that's going on with the camera, tell us, what was the last job you did, and, you know, just what was the parameters of the shoot?
It was, yeah, fascinating. It was, no, it was great. It was babies and toddlers and all the sort of reasons that you want to not shoot film, you know, like classically that, you know, if you're shooting things like animals or all that sort of stuff where you've really got to sit on a shot for a long time, you know, and just wait for the right moment. And again, sod's law that, you know, that the kid's going to do the right thing just as you run out of film. So it was...
Well, and there's also strict union and fair enough too, strict labour law type things on how long you can have a child on set.
Yeah.
So there's none of this, like, let's just run overtime. You've got to get it.
Exactly. It's the time factor of having to do those reloads as well, you know. But for me, it's about, you know, making sure I can get the moment and making it look nice, you know, having full 35mm depth of field, having something that's really compact. I do a lot of stuff. I like to sort of do either on a bungee rig or handheld. So it's a really nice compact. The Genesis is a monster, you know. It's got 50 million cables coming out of it and it weighs a ton. And, it's a lot easier to sort of carry around.
Can I just ask
you
about monitoring on set? Because the camera has currently an HD output on the side.
Yeah.
In the normal video village, the agency is sitting around, and to that matter, the, you know, video assist is normally a PAL or NTSC. Did you have a down converter, or did you have an HD kind of?
Yeah, I mean, it is still a little bit sort of fiddly. We were watching everything. We don't do an awful lot of playback. It's only sometimes you're like, did we get it, didn't we? We can swap over. But most of the time, everyone's watching, you know, those nice Panasonic, I think the 17-inch, it's really nice sort of watching high def straight out of the SDI out of the back of the camera. And then we were splitting off to a little Hi8 clam or a DV clam, I guess. And then, yes, for playbacks, we would have to swap back to standard def.
But let me just ask you this: what's the agency's perspective on this? I mean, do they want to see? I mean, are they expecting to see HD?
Them going, obviously you have to almost sort of drag them kicking and screaming to the red. You know, it's very much
Some resistance to it.
Well, it's something new, but now let me tell you. You know, as soon as we did it. The client has this almost like, you know, if you're shooting with McDonald's, they have this huge book of, you know, how to do it, how to shoot with us, you know, how to shoot our product.
Yeah.
This same client had this had almost this guidebook of all the things we must do. We must have, you know, if we're shooting, the house needs to have a big enough room to keep babies, you know, standby babies. We need so many children that we need to shoot with all this sort of stuff, and they've now added must shoot on, you know, Red or equivalent kind of thing to that list because,
oh, really?
Yeah, because it was such a sort of production bonus, I suppose, and from the ability to sort of roll and roll and, you know, the quality of the images and all that, for all
well,
of
we
the
discussed
reasons.
That, you know, that as I said, the thing about the labor laws and just being able to have the ability to shoot and keep shooting. And
yeah,
I remember with 950s when we were doing a shoot, I was like, we had a baby, like really newborn kind of thing. And it was 1 hour on set, right? Didn't matter where they were, under the lights or not, 1 hour. And I said, look, we've got 1 hour's worth of tape in here, and just switch on and don't switch off. And under no circumstances, switch off. Mm. I mean, there's just no point, right?
Yeah.
We'll just strange the tape when the baby leaves.
Well, that was the same thing. This was essentially, one of the shots was all sort of toddlers and things, and another whole commercial was almost like 6-month-old babies. So yeah, we knew we had like an hour or two in front of the camera and had a whole commercial to shoot. So yeah, you just want to sort of go and never really turn it off.
Well, now let's turn our attention to some of the things that have been happening this week or so in Red World. And now you wouldn't have been shooting with Build 15, right?
No, we're 14.
Okay, because I think there's a couple of interesting things happening. Round 14, we went to the 2K, 3K, and 4K thing, and now of course we've done a few more things in 15, and I'll get to that in a sec. But give me your impression of the idea of shooting on 3K. Is it okay? Or
yeah, look, I mean, I think when it was shown to me on the back of the camera, they kind of just toggled between, you know, this is 4K, this is 3K, and it wasn't a massive sort of difference. So, I mean, obviously, the whole reason I fought for the camera was to be able to have all the pluses of something like a 950, but to have the depth and to have any sort of changes of cropping meant I'd have to start going with wider lenses and, you know, lose that depth. So it was sort of counterproductive.
It's quite a jump from 4 to 2K, isn't it, in terms of what it's giving you for field of view?
Yeah, but the 4 to 3 is fine. It really, I mean, I don't want to give a percentage because someone will say it's not quite right. 10%. It was only about 10%, and it was not the whole. It was not the difference between going from you have to change one. You have to go one lens wider or tighter to compensate. So we shot for most of the stuff. We shot 4K, 2:1, 16:9.
But your target,
and we took our 16:9 out of the 2:1.
But your target for all of this is to do stuff for, presumably, what is going to be standard definition television, right?
Yeah.
I mean, high quality, but 16:9, but still this day.
16:9 and just keep 4:3 safe.
So there's this sort of urban myth thing about I shoot the wide and punch in for the close-up, but is that something that's just, would that be sloppy filmmaking, or did you actually...
Well, we actually showed, obviously, just by, you got the focus check button there, you know, you press that and you punch in like...
And who hasn't actually gone to roll with the focus button pressed in and thinking that that's the framing? Oh, no, I didn't. Everyone does that the first time.
It's a real trap.
Because it still looks great.
Yeah, there is no, even just on the onboard viewfinder, there's no receptible sort of difference.
Well, apart from all the guides have suddenly popped off.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So
and there's that little,
I don't have any lines.
Thing comes up in the bottom right to say you could scroll around your zoom area, but I know it's like so deceptive.
Yeah, but we're shooting with kids, so I had the I sort of basically said to the agencies and the clients, I just showed them that the focus check button and said, look, even if we blow up this much, it's still way more quality than we need.
Because we used to work, what, like 20%, right, on film?
You'd, yeah, that's
right. You
tell
us when you do a 10, maybe 20%
exactly.
blow up, and it's
exactly,
going to start
exactly. But you know, now you can go whatever that is from the focus
a
check
lot.
Button's got to be like 200% or something incredible.
Oh, yeah. And it's still that even when you're looking on this, what is effectively a 720p monitor on the output, and you hit the focus assist, it's still half the resolution of what the sensor's getting.
Yeah, and it's still way more than quality than, you know, for most projects than you need.
I always think the funniest thing is put a PAL frame on top of a 4K image and go, that postage stamp, that's PAL, that's NTSC, that's what we're dealing with.
Yeah, but I actually sort of basically put it to the agency that, look, you know, if one of these shots, we don't get a tight, we get a wide shot, and then when we go and punch in for the tight shot, the kid just, you know, doesn't want to play the game. We've got our tight shot in our wide shot. Every time you shoot a wide shot, there's the tight in there if you really need it. Obviously, it's not ideal, but it's that safety net that's there, and that, I think that was, you know, that was a real
well, we were lucky enough to get Build 15 in time for our last shoot, which was like yesterday, and we were shooting 120 frames a second, 2K stuff, and I must admit, I enjoyed the playback on the back of the camera for that because it was a fairly long lens, like it was about a 75mm lens. We had a bunch of people, think a kind of a Chariots of Fire running shot, except for it was against green screen and they were American tourists. And we were really aimed really tight at their stomachs.
Apart from that, it was just like
Chariots of Fire. Yeah. Yeah. And the funny thing was, though, that we were all sort of having them bustling and looking like they're trying to push each other out of the way. And at normal speed, it was actually kind of hard to know what you got. And so the 120 frame playback off the back of the camera.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, it's such a joy because on the F900, you used to always worry if you rewound something that you would be never touch that because somebody could go over a take.
Yeah.
But you're not going to do that, which is good.
The playing back at your shooting speed is that's a fantastic thing, you know.
And the other thing is, you know, when they went 14 with the different quality settings on the stuff like the 36 and the lower, I mean, I just never change it. I was high quality on everything.
It was, I think, which was just 36. That's how it was set, and I'm sure there's no difference between the two. But it was, you know, obviously normally you shoot over speed, and you've got to always got to sort of do, oh, okay, I'm going to play it back to the clients or whatever, and say, and kind of then you have to do the explanation as to, well, it won't be quite this fast. It'll be a little bit slower than that, and you know, obviously you're going frame. It's horrible having to do sort of, you know, playback of slow-mo off a DV deck or something like that. So it's wonderful to sort of play back off the laptop or straight out the back of the camera at slow-mo straight after you shot it. It's just that's fantastic.
So we also had, because we had upgraded the camera from the original 22 to 22X, we were playing with audio yesterday, and it was a joy to be able to get the audio because it was a lot of dialogue, and as we were discussing earlier, it's so intrusive to clapper everything and do stuff, so losing that was great. But, I mean, obviously, monitoring on the camera, real pain in the butt, so you do want the second separate audio sound recorders to do the master levels. They just feed you a balanced signal.
Yeah, they would always sort of, you know, make sure they're recording a proper safety copy, the real copy that you'd mix to on the DAT machine. But, they'd be feeding you...
It must be good for you as a director to have sunk rushes, you know, effectively as soon as you walk off set.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other thing is that if we don't really need to, or if it's intrusive, or again, children or whatever, to not have to throw a slate in people's faces is, you know, is great. It's just another, you know, just to be able to, you look over and nod to the camera. Are you rolling? Yep, let's go.
Yeah, there are a bunch of other things in Build 15, especially things to do with some of the... focus and the false color stuff like that, but we weren't really using that because, I mean, at the end of the day, you can almost get a bit too clever with some of that stuff. Like, if you've got a good focus puller and things are working well, then
that was another thing. We again, we never used the viewfinder. We always had, you know, the Panasonic 17-inch monitors everywhere, and we were doing stuff like macro babies' eyelashes, you know, and going for, and I'm standing there going, go to the hand, go to the back hand, go to the foot. I'm talking them through it. So you've got an operator, you've got me, and you've got a focus puller, all watching off a 17-inch monitor. And in the past, obviously, the focus puller can't see what he's doing, so he's got a whispering to the operator, and he's going, go back forward a bit, go to the forward hand. They're communicating as well. So now we didn't have to do any of that. There's always that delay when you pan from one thing to another. But the focus puller's got to see, oh, where are we going? Okay, I'll pan over there. He could see exactly what we're doing, and we knew when we had it. There was no sort of, I'm not sure.
Let's go. We saw that yesterday because the DOP had his eye to the eyepiece. Because we're on Build 15, the focus puller is looking at the LCD, which is obviously now angled around away from where it would traditionally be. And then we've all got the Video Village with both the Panasonic HD monitor, but we also had a CineTel with a scope in it built in and stuff. And so the fact that we finally got all those working at once, huge, huge benefit. Hey, I wanted to talk to you about accessories now, and in particular, of course, that whole idea of getting monitoring going. And one of the big things, the first sort of big aftermarket thing, is the idea of a breakout valve. Now, I'd have to say, you brought this up the second you saw the camera.
It's a solution for a problem that should never have happened. You know, it's having those little, whatever they are, mini BNCs, whatever they are, it's so unset friendly. The moment a dolly grip, you know, pushes the cable over, dollies over the cable, or someone stands on the video split lead, you know, I'm sure the camera body be heading back for a repair. It's just, you've got to have some, that'd be the first accessory, before you get anything, to get some kind of breakout box, I think, just to make those connectors, you know, set friendly, and also to adapt to adapt it to, you know, real world. What are those mini beams? Who uses those?
Well, I mean, the argument was that they'd have had to make the camera an inch wider if they'd had them internally.
Sure, but sure. Well, they'll all be an inch wider now that everyone's got their breakout boxes on.
You saw where I was going with that. But one thing that's kind of interesting is that there are more than one, right? There's Element Technica, which probably has the smallest and cutest breakout box. But yeah. I think you found a couple of others, haven't you?
Well, there's Sim Video has a couple. I think they've got one that is just a straight one. That's got a few plugs, and it looks like it's a little bit more substantial. Not that the Element Technica one is not; they all look fantastic. But they also, I think, they make one that does a bit of. Should do my homework. They do one that does a bit of down converting as well, which would be fantastic if you've got just your standard definition Video Village, you know, all that gear. If you want to be really compatible with
now
that,
you're talking about the Mini BNC breakout box. But I mean, is anyone doing one that covers the audio for these Mini XLRs?
I don't know. Well, just saw it today on the Red User. Was this AirC LAN breakout box, which looks like Battleship Potemkin. It is a massive thing. It looks like, what I can tell, it looks like every single connector gets broken out into this thing on the side of the camera, where basically you're not wanting for anything. Everything, all of the mini XLRs become big XLRs. All of the mini BNCs become big BNCs. It's a massive thing. And it looks like you can, what looks really interesting is that it looks like you can put a extension cable on it. Do your homework, Jace. I'm not sure. I only literally saw it today as I was running out the door, but it looks really interesting. But either way, I think, you know, that's a definite, you know, got to have one of those. And the very next thing, as soon as I saw the camera, was you need to have another way of hanging the viewfinder off these things. The little, adjustable kind of arm is really not.
But actually, you wanted to go a step further, I remember, because it wasn't just enough to have the viewfinder more firmly attached to the body of the camera. You were talking about having it independently. You explain.
Obviously, most film cameras, you've got the main viewfinder, but you've also got an extension viewfinder if you sort of got the camera down low on a hi-hat and you're sitting on a box, and you've got to bring the viewfinder up to you. So essentially it's an extension viewfinder to have get it up further away. And also if you're doing tilting or any sort of camera moves, you're running around on dolly, and if you're doing sort of massive tilts, you want to sort of do anything you can to sort of keep the viewfinder in the same place. So obviously for the film camera solutions, they have an extension viewfinder, which basically brings the eyepiece closer to you, and they have an eyepiece leveler, which attaches that long end of the viewfinder arm down to the head, so that when you tilt, the lens might go up and down, but the viewfinder stays right in the same space. So it's just a really nice operating, you know, basically it's operator comfort, really, and it's, you know, it's a standard issue piece of film kit, and you know, it looks like someone's made one. Obviously Element Technica are working on things. There's some they've got a really nice looking mount there, which would be great for handheld, but Sim Video have a fantastic sort of handle and extension video combo thing. It makes the camera look a little bit Betacam-ish, but I think it's really sort of keep it simple, stupid. It's really fantastic. It looks like a really interesting rig, and lets you put an eyepiece leveler on it, and a really sort of an interesting, you know, simple way of mounting things. And
I've got to say, the one that I saw this week that I was pleased to is completely different from that. It's as simple as the on-off button. And that's something that attaches from ViewFactor Studios to the Red Grip handle to allow me to have a thumb button off, button on when it's on a shoulder mount. Now, we have a remote button on off and it works great. But of course, you know, what you want to be able to do is operate that while it's on your shoulder. And I only saw this today, but I think it's only a prototype stage, but does it have an awful lot of LEDs for an on-off button?
Well, I guess it's telling... Again, come on, we've got to do our research, Mike, before...
I found it.
Okay, what do all the LEDs do, Mike?
I don't know what all the LEDs do. It's only a prototype. Okay. I don't think they know what the LEDs do.
It's got power and record on it for a start. I presume it's... Obviously, it lets you know when it's running and lets you know when, you know, your camera's powered up and ready to go. Looks like it might. I think it might even have a beep. I think obviously it's great on the handheld rig, but it looks like it's really going to be a fantastic design for a remote role at the end of a crane when you can't see lights, you can't see sort of displays on the camera, and you want to know, is it rolling? Is it not? You know.
Well, in fairness, this thing is the size of an American quarter, right?
Yeah, it is fantastic.
But it has a GPI thing on it and a little thing that looks like a mute button. Now, I don't know what the mute button is.
What's GPI, Mike?
It's got to do with triggering.
Okay.
To trigger... Well, because there's two things that the camera... You want... See, let's take, for example, the event of a in-camera slow-mo change, right?
Right.
So I have a power-on button, obviously, and that's at the back. Then I then have a roll button that actually starts recording, right? A record button. That's what this is here. But there's also the concept of the event trigger, because when I hit record, I need a second something to tell it when to go from 75 frames a second down to 30.
Trigger speed ramps through that. Yeah. So it's fantastic.
So that's your event trigger. And that's also used for other things like stop frame stuff. And, you know, because if you can put the camera in manual mode for doing stop frame, then you obviously need to have it button on for it's a take, but it doesn't actually record a frame until you press the button. And of course, if it's the same button, when you press it the second time, it just turn it off.
Yeah. No, look, it's amazing. The size of the thing, it looks fantastic to be able to tell you when it's rolling, you know, to be able to then trigger ramps or whatever. It looks fantastic.
Yes.
How much is it?
I don't know how much it is.
Well, it's a prototype.
It's like come out today and it's a prototype.
Yeah. No, it looks fantastic. And again, it's something that's a bit of an essential thing, really. When you're in handheld mode, you want to have something there, right there on your handles. It's really simple.
Now, we're not going to go through every accessory today because obviously we're going to keep some for next time.
Absolutely.
But there is one that has come out, or rather a piece of software that we'd be remiss if we didn't discuss. And I see you've got the crimson stuff in front of you. And
I was hoping you could decipher it for me. What does it mean?
Decipher it? Well, basically there's a workflow that was engineered that has a path towards Avid. Now, I should say that this is like the thing that's probably changing the fastest. And being a bit of an Apple guy, I'm not actually adverse at all to doing stuff with Avid. In fact, I quite like Avid.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not a problem for me. But we've engineered those workflows through what were effectively, I guess, alpha versions of this. So this is much more of a workflow control device in the sense that it allows me to get... Because the problem you've got is you need to be able to get time code and file name, obviously effectively real names, through to the Avid workflow. And if we don't do that, then we're in trouble. And if we, you know, break the time code, then we're pretty much buggered. And the other thing is being able to get back for the conform on that. And so...
Basically anything that does anything for Avid workflow is obviously all the editors I use are all Avid guys, and it's probably the one thing that can stop me in my tracks from saying yes or no to the next shoot. Is it on red or not? Because it, you know, it's depending on how much time I've got for post. In fact, I had to through gritted teeth say shoot my job last week on 16mm because we just didn't have the turnaround time to let us go through red, which I would have done. And again, I'm sure everyone would have been impressed and said, oh, forget 16, if we can't afford 35, we'll be doing red on these projects from now on.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that there are a bunch of things coming, and this is all going to happen in the next couple of weeks, because one of the things that we want to have happen is Scratch to be able to output video in real time. So it could take the R3D files, play them out in real time, and run them into an Avid digitizing station, which is exactly what we have done on Telecine for years, right? Only real time, but hey, it's better than, you know, a fifth real time. And that's actually held up by the darndest of things. It can actually play video out in real time. It can take the R3Ds in,
right,
apply something to them, shrink them down, and play them out as PAL or NTSC in real time. What it can't do, however, is get the time code out because of an NVIDIA card problem. So we're that close to a whole bunch of breakthroughs. And plus, of course, there's nothing stopping the Scratch guys at Assimilate actually writing a native DNxHD direct file out. Like, you could actually just export that format as opposed to exporting QuickTime. You know, the biggest problem I have with Avid's is the friggin' codec is hard to remember. I get the, I know there's a D in there, there's an X in there, there's an HD. It's a DNX HD. Doesn't roll off the tongue quite the same way that Red does.
Yes.
Thank God they didn't call the Red the X14PA. It took me forever to remember that the P2 camera was called the HVX200.
If it was built by Microsoft, maybe.
But yeah, so the Crimson stuff, I'd really suggest you guys check it out. There's a free download, and it's improving the workflow in post-production for getting through to offline. And
for me, anything that makes that workflow as close as possible to, you know, I don't mean be a stick in the mud, but basically the more it conforms or the more it works in with the existing, the way things work, you know, the better it's going to be, the quicker it's going to be, and, you know, the less fuss and less resistance I get from everybody. You know, really, I'm sure there's lots of guys out there who really feel like you're sort of dragging everyone kicking and screaming into the 21st century by trying to push people to shoot on this thing. And anything that's going to make that back end of it, you know, easier is just going to make it an easier sell, and that's going to be better for everyone, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, managing the offline workflow is remarkably the bit that is the most difficult.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, still it's going to be pretty much hampered by the fact that you need the QuickTime plugin. Everything is going to pretty much always run easier on a Mac, except for Scratch itself, which runs only on PC and not on Mac. So it's an ironic situation.
I think it's a whole show in itself. The whole workflow thing is...
We've done a sort of a summary of this in FX Guide TV, part two just out. And even in the time it's taken since we recorded it, it's changed.
Mm.
So hopefully this is something that we're going to be able to get into. We probably won't get into it in a lot of depth because we're out of time for this week, but we probably, when we come back next time, we'll get into that. And also, we'd really like to do is get emails from you guys, because if there are things you want us to discuss, things you want us to research, then we're in a good position to be able to answer those questions. And quite frankly, I think that'll be, moving forward, a tremendous source of information for us, as well as you know, us being able to answer questions for you. So from things like, you know, how does it work with different lens stuff and different, I don't know, follow focus things, right through to post-production and how it works with different codecs and understanding some of the stuff. We're really happy to answer those questions. So we have an email address. And so Jace, what's our email address for people who want to send in questions and tell us things that that they have themselves discovered?
Tell us things we got wrong. redcenter@fxguide.com. And that is...
That is spelled like an Australian would spell it.
Spelled like an Australian would spell it. C-E-N-T-R-E. Red
Not
Center.
C-E-N-T-E-R.
Exactly.
Though we can probably make it so that both work. But
I'm sure we can.
But yes. So we're out of time. Thank you so much, my friend, for coming in.
Thanks, mate. That's brilliant. Great. Yeah, like, that's good. I think it's be really good to sort of start getting cutting through the swathe of bullshit out there.
Yeah, and we'll try and come each week with what's happened and what's new. So obviously a couple of weeks in we'll have caught up with the real world, but that couple of weeks time also pins us at NAB, and we've already been speaking to the guys, and we'll continue to, and we'll bring you what's going on with, of course, Scarlett, which is the... Do you want to, this far out, take a educated guess?
A wish list thing. It's been extremely funny watching, listening, and looking at the Scarlett prediction blog. But what I'd love to see would be something like a 25 frames a second version of my Nikon D200 or something. Small,
see, it's funny you should say
simple
that.
Nikon lenses on it, or, you know, a lens mount. But not full 35.
Look, last year when we asked Ted, he said it was a professional camera and it wasn't a toy and it wasn't plastic.
Yeah.
And my predictions are, and we don't want to be speculating, but this is a good one. It's such a unique one. I think it's going to be 4K. They've committed to 4K so hard, I can't say they'll go back down to 2K. I think you're absolutely right. If it could have a Nikon lens mount, then for a start, it's accessible, right? Because everybody can get at those lenses, and it stops them from having to go to a B4, and it stops them from having to only work in 35mm lenses. And you know what? I mean, it would be just huge, because there are so many people in our industry that have good glass for their stills cameras.
Yeah.
And yes, they won't work well as a zoom lens, but they will work as a variable prime lens. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's exactly how you sort of treat it. Basically, if you look at something like a D200 or any of those things, they're like 10 whatever megapixels, and they can shoot 3 or 4 frames a second. We only need to shoot whatever 4 megapixel or 2 megapixel at 25 frames. You know, the it's not far off. It's not much of a stretch to think that it could be something that's more than something the size of a little D40 something.
Yeah, the only three things I want, and I think one of them is for certain, is I want it to be cheaper. I want it to use stills lenses, and I want it to be 4K. If we get those three, well, and quite frankly, if it is those three, they are going to sell a ton.
Absolutely. So you're going to NAB?
Yep, we're going to have a whole crew there. And it's funny, I was on set yesterday and I was talking about this stuff, and one of the guys said, look, if you see the Crimson, maybe you could, you know, put my name down as well. And I was like, that would make it the 10th person that's asked me for a Scarlet.
So make it 11, Mike. You can put one. Because I'm sure, being a red owner, the whole sort of thing of you probably get to the front of the queue.
We do. Well, that's what Jim said anyway, that we'd be rewarded for being first out of the gate with the red one, which is nice of them, I think.
Yeah. I had a question for you, Mike, actually. You have Camera 22. What was it when you ordered it? It was probably there's probably very little known about these cameras. What was it that made you hit the buy button and send them the money back then? It's like ancient history, you know, hardly everyone would really have known what the hell
it
was about.
Well, I guess there's two things. I mean, the first and the simple answer is Graham Natras, right? I mean, everybody speaks in glowing terms about Jim, and Jim's a great guy, but I got to tell you that it was Graham that. You know, because Graham Natra is somebody I respect and he's really good at what he does. And I heard Graham and I knew what Graham was sort of capable of. And when I saw the camera come out, I was, you know, it was the post, like they'd solved 4K in post.
Yeah.
And obviously the camera price point was good. And we'd have got a lower number had I not been dicking around talking to Ted in the bloody pavilion. And the time I turned around, people had got in front of me in the queue and we got to 22. In fact, I'd got 21, but the guy in front of me bought 2, so I got pushed back to 22.
I think the camera I used down in Auckland where we shot the last spot is 23 or something.
Yep, standing behind me in the queue. And you know what? I mean, I have to say that as long as it was under 25, so we got it in the first batch, I was cool. I didn't really care what the number was, but I did want to get one early so we could work out workflow. And that worked well. But look, there are so many of them out. They're now shipping over 1200s.
Oh, we're up to, exactly, in the 1200s.
Okay, well, look, as I said, send in your emails. So great talking to you guys. And hopefully we can be doing this pretty much every fortnight. I think probably every week's a bit excessive, especially with everyone's schedules. But let's go for every fortnight. And Jason, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Mike. It's been great.
And we'll talk to you guys later. See ya.